authorize this festive little Christmas brunch?
Ho, ho, ho! It's time for Again With This, Melrose Place. I hope this is a Christmas episode based on that first clip. Ho, 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 ho! And now here is your episode stuff. Season 3, episode 15, Ho, Ho, Holiday on Ice. Oh, here are your hosts. Yeah, all right.
Hi.
Hello. I'm one of your hosts, Sarah D. Bunting. Hello, Tara and Dave.
Hi. I'm Tara.
I have some news. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Great. Again with this, episode 36 is dropping February 26, Rush Week. Mm-hmm. Here's what it entails. Thanks to a thought-provoking suggestion from Patreon supporter Christopher K., we will be casting 90210 spinoff prequels for the parents slash older characters on the show. No, that does not mean Andrea. We're talking about Rush Sanders, the Walshes, that kind of thing. Who might play a young Mrs. Teasley? What would Play It Again Samantha be about? You'll find out February 26th if you're a Patreon supporter, and please do join us. We do have a good time.
We do. Also, this week is the February episode of Again With Them, our recap podcast of Jenny Garth and Tori Spelling's 90210 recap podcast, 90210MG. And that will drop Thursday, February 25th for all of our Patreon supporters at the $5 level and up.
Please join us at whatever level at patreon.com/againwiththis.
Oh, please do. All right. Holiday on Ice. Dave is right. Or should I say Santa Dave? Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Merry Christmas, Dara. Merry
Who are you
Christmas,
calling
Sarah?
Hose?
Your mic is over there. He's just talking into his windscreen.
Santa doesn't know how to use this new technology, but Dave does. I hope you've both been very good girls this year. If so, you'll get presents. If not, murdered in your sleep.
Wow. The Starverse shows.
Ho, ho, ho.
Okay. They love this Christmas B-roll. The same shots were used in the season 2 Christmas episode of 90210. I did check again. Wow. I am unwell. The spinning Porsche with Santa in the back. Seen it. Santa's yep. sled with reindeer over the street. Yep. And mm-hmm. the giant Christmas tree. Yes, indeed. All recycled for this episode. Which, let's get into it, starting with our E-plot, such as it is. Relations start to thaw for Sydney and her father. I'm just going to shorthand this. Jane talks Sydney into going home for Christmas. That's it.
Yeah. They couldn't afford the white shadow. We don't even hear his end of the conversation.
Nope.
It's well acted by Laura Layton. Mm-hmm. A Merry Christmas to all.
Yep. The one thing I want to note here, other than that, is that we see as Sydney's leaving that Jane has a fully decorated tree in her living room, even though she's also going home to Chicago for Christmas. Like, why go to the trouble? It's a full size Christmas tree.
Yeah. Also, why? How did you pay for that? Chris got and then stole
yes!
all your money.
Great point. Oh, my God. All right. Moving on to our D plot. Terry tries to 13th step with Allison. Oh, Terry. So Allison's reading on a bench outside at Twin Oaks when Billy comes to see her. She thought he was going home for the holidays, but it turns out he couldn't get the time off from Scrooge Amanda, whom we will get to and how. He brought Allison a Christmas gift. It's a music box he already gave her, I guess. She's like, oh, our music box. I do not remember him giving it to her the first time at all. Like,
I think it might have been in the first season when it was like part of their best besties arc or whatever.
Maybe. I mean, he not a Christmas present because he gave her that necklace. That
yes.
was supposed, the ugly necklace.
Fugly, turn your neck green.
Yeah.
So, job. I don't know. Yeah.
Whatever. I
Who
guess
cares?
We were supposed to remember it, but we don't. His gifts are forgettable, and so is he. So she comments that it's weird how clear everything is now that she's sober, including the pain that she caused him. She does not know why he stayed with her for so long. He says it's because he loved her. She loved him, too. And she sighs that this was supposed to be their first Christmas together as man and wife. Barf. But he says Christmas doesn't count this year. He's not feeling it, which no wonder if he did not get it off from work. But she knows what he means. And they're hugging when Terry rolls up looking jealous and then saunters off without either of them seeing. And then Christmas night, Allison's loading her plate at the buffet when Terry pulls her away to ask whether she's going back to Billy. She's not sure. He reminds her that it never worked out all the other times the two of them tried. No one knows her pain like Terry does. And she says Billy is very forgiving. He is? And
oh, is this a different Billy from the one who was like, I'm sorry that your father assaulted you for years on end and also your yeah. sister. Deal with your shit in the next 5 minutes or I'm out. Also, I bought a new car. Bye.
Yeah.
That Billy?
Yeah.
Huh.
Hmm. She also says he'll try to understand. Again, citation needed, but.
Well, I mean.
I mean, I guess he'll try.
Given his, like, evident difficulty in comprehending things. At times.
Okay, fair. Fair.
Mongo struggle with nuance.
He do. He do. But Terry says he doesn't have to try. This is not a sexual conquest. Terry is falling in love with her. She says she cares about him, too. He says she's told him things she's never told Billy, but she's like, it's therapy?
Yeah.
Like, Jesus, Terry.
Gross.
And as it happens, Terry has maneuvered her under the mistletoe, and when he starts kissing her, she doesn't stop him. And, you know, again, he's being very inappropriate, but we also get it.
Yeah.
So we do have three more plot lines to get to. But first, we're back with another message from Reva about CarrieBradshawIsTheWorst.com. Now that the site has five full seasons posted, here are the top five reasons Carrie Bradshaw was the worst in season five.
Number one, when Samantha gets back with Richard during Carrie's bout of writer's block for her shitty column, Carrie pitches a column called Desperate Women Who Will Believe Anything. A clear dig at Samantha when Carrie is the last person alive who should be judging anyone.
Number two. In Atlantic City, Carrie blows on a guy's dice for luck at the craps table. When he wins $12,000, he gives her a $1,000 chip, which she subsequently refuses to give Miranda to gamble. Miranda was willing to give Carrie $15,000 of her own money to buy her apartment, but Carrie can't be bothered to give her someone else's money? Okay, sure.
Number three, being a judgmental bitch again towards Samantha when she walks in on Samantha giving a blowjob to Joe, her Worldwide Express guy.
Number four, dragging Samantha on a cross-country train trip from New York to San Francisco for a book signing only to kick Samantha out of their hotel room so Carrie can bone big.
And number five, obsessing over her breakup with Aiden, triggered by Nina Katz, face girl, going so far as to even stalk Nina down to explain Carrie's side of things. No one cares.
Want even more reasons why Carrie Bradshaw is the worst? Because, believe us, there are plenty.
There's a site for that. Visit CarrieBradshawIsTheWorst.com today.
All right, on to our C-plot. Showering Matt with gifts has unintended consequences for Jeffrey. Before we get into it, congratulations to Matt for being in the middle of the plot pack. Two plots.
So exciting.
Less important. Wow. So at what appears to be a residence for people living with AIDS, Jeffrey helps Matt bring in holiday donations that he collected at the hospital. Although one of them you noted in the visual aids is yogurt.
What the? I really feel like the prop people were like, well, we need stuff sticking out and like the usual loaf of French bread and celery tops were
sure.
not appropriate.
Yep.
It really is one of those bit like the big half gallon of Dan and Light. Like,
yep.
Guys, at least put some paintbrushes in there. Like, what donations exactly are you getting? Because it yep. didn't seem like it was food.
No. Well.
And also yogurt.
Yeah.
You know, the traditional Christmas lemon chiffon. What?
So the director is warm and positive and describes their work in a very low-key way, but Jeffrey still can't wait to get out and admits outside that he's very uncomfortable being around other people who are HIV positive. He feels no dread or impending doom. He is certain he will not end up like those residents have. And Matt's like, okay. And then it's time for presents. And apparently Jeffrey has fully spoiled Matt with a million expensive things, including a first-class cruise to the Bahamas, which, like, is Jeffrey not unemployed? I thought he was.
Yeah.
But they're supposed to leave tomorrow, which Matt says he can't do. Jeffrey says he can. He already talked to Matt's boss. Yikes. Okay. Matt is worried about Jeffrey being able to afford all this, and Jeffrey kind of tightly says that when someone offers you a gift, you don't ask to see a bank statement, which, true, but when they have a potentially fatal virus and are not seeking mental health counseling about it, you might surmise that they're wildly spending in anticipation of ending their own life before the disease does it for them. Maybe. I mean, that's what I was thinking. We were supposed to think Matt was thinking.
Yeah, or just like, I won't be around when the credit card bill arrives.
Right, yeah.
Slightly less dark, but still like, please get a therapist. Yeah. Please, you deserve it.
But neither of those is quite Matt's concern. Clip two.
Jeffrey, it just feels like you're running away. Ouch. I mean, don't analyze it. I mean, God's sakes, Matt. I mean, it's not that damn complicated. You know, I followed orders for 10 years in the Navy. I mean, when to eat, when to sleep. I mean, hell, I even needed permission to use the latrine. And then one day, my medical report says I'm HIV. I mean, all of a sudden, I'm a walking fatality. I mean, contrary to military guidelines, not everything in life fits into these neat, precise categories.
Jeffrey, I know your life changed, but I don't care if you take a trip. Go wherever you want. Do whatever you want. You're a grown-up. But this is crazy. I mean, blowing your entire savings on one trip? What about your future?
Future? Man, my future is in the eyes and faces of every man in that hospice. I mean, there is no down the road for me. I mean, this is it. I mean, this moment is the only thing I can be sure of. And I refuse to spend the rest of my life, no matter how long that may be, like, hoping to survive. I gotta live now! If you can't handle that, well, then maybe we don't belong together.
It's more the fact that you act like a tween all the time and can't manage your emotions and impulses that are the issue.
Yeah. Therapy.
Yeah. Also, AZT.
Yeah.
It existed.
It's the mid-90s. Like, buddy.
Yeah. Come on.
So Jeffrey is supposed to be getting on a plane for his cruise some number of days later when he comes to see Matt at the hospital instead. He says he made a big mistake last night. Matt thinks he did too. They can work this out. But Jeffrey's like, oh, I wasn't wrong to leave. I just left for the wrong reasons. Clip three.
Jesus.
But you're not here to make up?
Oh.
Look, Matt, we can't make up. I'm really sorry. I mean, I had no business being in this relationship in the first place.
True.
Thanks for not dragging it out.
Matt, stop it. Look, you know I love you. I mean, but even under the best of circumstances, I mean, I've never been good at commitments.
What are you saying, Jeffrey, that you don't want to be with someone? Someone who's willing to help you to listen?
Of course I do. And I hope you'll always be that person. But please, Matt, don't make your support conditional.
You said that you were willing to make a commitment.
Look, the only commitment I can honestly make right now is to myself. But anything else just feels like more pressure.
Hey, we'll be friends, right?
The best. I mean, the best.
No, we will never see him again. This is the last episode, so no.
I could have sworn he came back after this and he maybe mentioned, I don't recall. Like, I don't know. On the one hand, I respect that the writers were like, well, there's nowhere else to go with this here right. in 1994. Fine.
Yeah.
But, ugh, poor Matt. And yeah. Jeffrey, Jesus. Like, I know you're not a real person, but get therapy, please. Please.
Get fictional therapy. You fictionally need it really yes, badly.
I'm sure they have a therapist on your fictional Prince cruise lines. It's fine.
I hope you're getting therapy on Chicago PD for real.
He needs it there too. Yikes.
Yeah, it's also too bad. I mean, we said this in the last episode with regard to Susan, like how this would go differently if this were a drama and not a soap. And like if yeah. it were a drama, you can imagine Jeffrey like still being around and actually being Matt's friend. Like there would be an economy where for mm-hmm. characters where it like Matt could have friends that don't live at Melrose Place. And that yeah. would be nice for him. And like, you know. It's reasonable to think that they would continue to be friends after dating because, you know, my impression anecdotally is that that is more common among gay partners than straight partners. Like that.
Yeah, I would agree. Anecdotally.
But, yes. But, you know, it's a soap. So when you're not dating, you have no story purpose. So bye bye.
Yeah. Ugh. Well.
Speaking of bye-bye.
See you in Scientology, Jeffrey.
Oh, yeah. And then out of it. So good for
yes.
him.
Yes. Woo.
All right, moving on to our B-plot. Jo finally gets her baby back, but her problems aren't over. Again, as we said in the last episode, not sure when Matt got involved in the true story of Michael Jr., but...
Yeah, off-screen.
Annoyingly. But he did, and now we see him confront Michael at the hospital about Kimberly's whole scheme. Kimberly may have overwritten baby Cortez's death certificate, but he still has a birth record. Michael sniffs that it doesn't mean anything. Matt tries to threaten Michael with what will happen if he doesn't return the baby to Joe, but Michael easily shoots back that Joe is implicated in the crime, too. Matt says Joe's willing to admit that. Again, why is all of this conversation happening without a lawyer present? Whatever. It's because it's a soap.
Yeah.
Michael says the baby will go into foster care, which Matt counters will be up to the courts. But Michael's pretty confident Joe will never get custody and adds that if anyone comes at him and Kimberly, they're taking everyone down with them, which I 100% believe. And apparently so does Matt because he's met them.
Yeah, he's familiar with their work.
Yeah. So then Michael's carrying in the Christmas tree Kimberly apparently made him buy, bitching the whole time about the expense, him, not her. She does not care and gets to work documenting the decoration process while Michael begs her to cool it on all the Christmas cheer. She ignores, including after he tells her about the blood test, which is why he doesn't want them to get too attached to Michael Jr. But Kimberly's sure Jo will not risk her child's happiness for her own selfishness. Wrong. Peter's leaving Amanda's when Michael grabs him to come and meet Jo. And at her place, she walks Peter through all the evidence of the baby theft scheme. So as soon as Peter gets to work, he calls Michael into his office to confront him about it, though not seeming that concerned under the circumstances.
These two are like, oh, my God. Anyway.
Their whole attitude through this conversation is like, broads, am I right? And like, they yeah, are.
Absolutely.
They are right.
It's like, yeah.
Anyway, God. Clip four.
Oh, I can explain that.
Don't. I don't want to know anything about this situation. But if half of what this woman says is true, then you've put this entire hospital at risk. Big risk.
Look, Dr. Burns, Joe's a very unstable.
She's sane and we both know it. Nobody jeopardizes me or my hospital. Do you understand?
Yes, but still.
Shut up, Mancini. If that baby isn't yours, give it back. Now.
Okay.
Once again, give it back. No. Okay, Shatner. Got it.
Yeah, it's not a bike. Like just there's a little more urgency to the situation, my dude. Like,
I know. You're anyway. Going to stop leaving Michael Jr. out in the driveway. I'm going to take it away. God.
So at the beach house later, Kimberly rages about getting called into work on Christmas Eve and missing their baby's first Christmas morning. Michael points out the baby won't know the difference and he won't start any Christmas shit without her. The boom mic, by the way, is also back at the door when he's sending her off. Bye-bye. And of course, while Kimberly's gone, Michael brings Michael Jr. over to Joe's place and hands him off, adding a stay the hell out of our lives on his way out. Like, bitch, it was your crazy wife's idea, but fine. But Joe doesn't care, bringing the baby over to the couch and giving his head a big sniff while she can. And the next day, Joe brings Jake by to meet the baby. Apparently he knew the whole story too, because she doesn't tell him when all this, like, happened. Annoying. Very annoying.
Too many plot lines. We did not need the, like, Mancini sisters spirit of Christmas thing. Like,
no.
Show this scene.
Yes.
Whatever.
Yeah. So Kimberly comes from home from work, psyched as hell to have her fun family Christmas, and Michael hugs her tighter and tighter in an apparent attempt to keep her from, like, looking around the house once she has bodily autonomy out of his arms. But eventually he does have to let her go and then tell her where the baby is. And she goes nuts, throwing the bassinet at him and shrieking at him for betraying her and trying to run into the ocean because the baby was the one thing she loved more than her life. Mm. And he runs after her and, over her resistance, pulls her out of the sea. And, you know, as I said in my caption for this in the visual aids, like, the time may come in the future when he will regret having stopped this, you know, from happening the way she wanted it to, because it only gets worse for her, really.
Yeah. I mean, as a reviewer, I was fine with it because it took a really long time. And also, wow, Marcia Cross committed.
100%.
In all the senses of that word.
Yep. So later, when Michael's in the shower, Kimberly phones the Carters, who have gone way the fuck overboard with the outdoor decorations in their yard, by the way, for two childless people.
Yeah. And yet, not far enough, because there's two flagrantly naked trees. Like, please do not stick color form outside decorations on this B-roll. Either Diker lights it or don't.
Yep. I'm with you. Anyway, you. Here's how that call goes. Clip 5.
Hello.
Hello, is this Mrs. Carter?
Yes, it is.
Mrs. Carter, you don't know me, but I'm about to give you a wonderful Christmas present.
Who is this?
I can't tell you who I am or how I know what I'm about to tell you, but Joe Reynolds' baby did not die.
Your grandson is alive and well, living in her apartment at this very moment.
And I thought you had a right to know. Merry Christmas.
Dun, dun, dun!
Oh, crazy baby napper versus crazy baby napper. What will happen?
Something dumb.
Yep.
Finally, our A plot. Bruce Christmas carols Amanda. Amanda storms into Peter's office to yell at him for threatening her and insinuating that she boned him to get her new job. The last time they saw each other some other night, which we all know why soap writing is like this, but this is a very weird way to recap their fight from a previous episode. Like, why didn't she just yell at him about it at the time? Like,
also, we just saw the previouslys, technically.
Right.
Also, that is not the weirdest thing about this scene.
No. So Peter says if she returned his calls, she would know he's been trying to apologize, but she's not interested and is filing a complaint. He doesn't think she has anything to complain about. Bruce is gone. Euphemism. She's running D&D. Peter gave her what she wanted. But Amanda resists the characterization that he gave her anything or that she owes him anything. And if he harasses her again, she will sue him. Peter? Clip 6.
Here's the bottom line. If you ever harass me again, I'll slap you with a lawsuit that'll make your head spin.
You are without a doubt the sexiest woman I've ever met.
What?
I love a woman who's willing to fight for what she believes in. You're strong and determined, and baby, when you play hard, and I find that extremely arousing.
The game's over, Peter. Cross me again, I'll see you in court.
Baby.
What? accent is being attempted. I was reminded watching this scene and feeling very merry indeed. Ho, 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 because it's funny. Mm-hmm. Especially since his hair is like really ridiculous. Like it looks like a snow saucer was inverted and put on his head.
So floppy.
When I was a records clerk at Barnard College, we had a running gag amongst the cubicle farm about the ads that were running at that time for Jekyll and Hyde, and the fact that they really sort of snuck up on you with that, this is the moment. Like it would be, you'd be like, go for a commercial for light bulbs straight into that. And like every time we'd be like, whew. So we started doing it to each other, like creeping under the cubicle level and then popping up next to like the donation staff, like this. And then one time there was an actual cape involved. I think Jack Wagner actually was the star of this production at some point.
Oh.
I know Hasselhoff was. That just reminded me of this. I don't, like, there's so many regions fighting each other in this accent. And also, he's both barely trying and it's 110% at the same time.
Like, yeah.
I love Jack Wagner in this part so much. It is so random and Shatner-y and yeah. I like it.
He's really having fun.
And so are we.
Indeed. So Amanda then goes to her office and walks into a holiday party, which she is instantly pissy about, even after Billy says he authorized it for the sake of morale. She snits that the morale boost is they all still have jobs and orders him to shut it down, but he laughs that it didn't cost anything. She does not care. Then enters her own office to see a lady in there. She's Donna Teller, and no, that's not a person named Donatella, who is from Boston. Donna space. Teller, sister of Bruce. She was okay until she remembered that Bruce died in Amanda's office and starts to get choked up. Like, why would that detail have been released to the family? Whatever. Anyway, Amanda doesn't have time for this shit and wearily sighs as she asks what Donna wants, which turns out to be some kind of financial consideration for Bruce's college-aged sons who were left with nothing, including tuition for their next semester, which is about to start. And not to be Amanda about it, but Bruce surely made in the six figures for many years before Peter and Amanda went after his business, and his lack of estate planning is not really Amanda's fault or problem.
No,
but
no, it's really not. It's a matter for probate.
Yes.
Call them.
Mm-hmm. They also have a mother, and she presumably has some of Bruce's money. She is not mentioned at all in this episode, by the way. But
yeah, why? Yeah, it's very weird. Like, why the sister? And why name the sister Donna Teller?
Yeah, I know.
Was his actual name Gianner? Just got there now. Anyway, I'm sure it's a coincidence, but what?
Anyway, instead of saying all of that, Amanda just snaps that she doesn't know what she can do, and they have this exchange, clip 7.
Bruce founded D&D. He put his life into it, literally. There must be something, a pension plan, an insurance policy, anything that might help his children continue their education.
Miss Teller, D&D is successful, but Bruce took out more than his share of profits. In fighting the divorce and the takeover, he borrowed from the corporate accounts. There are substantial personal loans in his name that now can never be repaid.
Because he's dead, Miss Woodward.
Yes, I know. Which is why I've written them off. But I'm also responsible to the shareholders.
You're telling me you won't do anything? You won't help at all?
Sorry.
I see. Well, I guess our problems aren't your problems anymore, are they? Merry Christmas, Miss Woodward.
Okay. Again,
like, that's not how any of this works. Have the estate's attorneys call the company's attorneys if you think you're owed something, which you already would have received because that is a matter for probate.
Yeah.
But then we don't get to do this thing, which mm-hmm. at least they didn't do. It's a Woodwardiful life.
Well, he already did that once, so he went to a different
well. Yeah, it went really well, too, so let's see how this goes.
So, having tried and failed to get out of a meeting at Twin Oaks to mend her relationship with Allison, Amanda attends, bitchily, Clip 8.
So, this is Camp Happy Talk. $12,000 for a month of psychobabble. Too bad we couldn't write it off as severance pay.
Amanda, if you feel that way, why'd you even bother to come?
Because everyone keeps harping about your delicate self-esteem. I wanted to give you fair warning. Billy may have fallen for this pathetic act, but I haven't. Legally, I can't fire you while you're sequestered here at Pity Me Pines. But don't plan on making a career at D&D.
Whew. That's what we've been waiting for. Whew, that's brisk, baby.
Yeah, she's like, bye. She's walking by Terry, tells Allison, like, oh, I thought you were exaggerating your group. But no, she is that bad. Wow. Because she is. Yeah. That night, Amanda's coughing a little in bed, but is properly awakened by lightning and thunderclaps. And then a backlit turtlenecked man appears in her doorway.
Who could it be?
Clip 9.
Hello, Amanda. My, my, you're not looking well at all.
Bruce. What are you doing here?
Why didn't you give my sister the money for my children?
You were their father. You should have made sure they were taken care of before you hung yourself.
Well, you misled Donna. You made it sound like the company was in trouble.
It was. We lost 3 major clients before you left.
But they're back. You have no excuse not to help my children. You know, I never would have killed myself if you hadn't pushed me out of D&D. You betrayed me, Amanda.
Stop it. It wasn't my fault.
Really? If you weren't guilty, I wouldn't be here.
You're not here. You are a dream. I am sick. I've got a fever.
Am I? The rope burn where I hung myself? It never heals. Touch it, Amanda.
Jesus, show. Merry Christmas.
Yeah, it's a little much.
I mean, why is Bruce like this manipulative, hard-ass now? Like,
right.
The ghost of Bruce's past actually seems like he might have been competent at running the agency. Where was that?
I'm with you. So Amanda snaps on the light, but then he is gone. And the next morning, she's still doing poorly on the couch when there's a knock at the door. She shambles over to get it. It's Peter, looking alarmed by the state of her and saying their plane leaves in an hour. She crabs that they're barely talking as she gets back on the couch because she is not going anywhere. And he tries to justify his possessiveness. He felt like pulling away. He felt her pulling away and was afraid of losing her. And he adds that she's probably wiped out from all their corporate raiding. She agrees. That's why she got sick. And then he offers to call in a prescription for her, which, like, nothing we have seen seems to be anything but a cold. Like, this is how antibiotic resistance happens, doctor.
Yeah.
Get her some fucking Theraflu. That's all she needs. Make her tea. Anyway.
Yeah, or leave. I think she'd feel a lot better if you just fucked off.
Well, she does in fact ask him to, but he wants to give her something first and brings in a gigantic box, which he then opens for her, and it's a fur coat, what every resident of Los Angeles needs. But she seems to be into it, and as he snuggles her in it, he tells her to push fluids and they'll go to Lake Tahoe when she's feeling better. Again, she just threatened to sue you. Like, do you still think you're going on vacation together, sick or not? I don't understand the state of your relationship, but whatever. So then there's B-roll of, like, the Christmas lights totally in full effect at the complex. Like, the whole storyline is Amanda's a total Scrooge, but she said that was fine. I mean, your note was maybe she was too sick to resist people putting them up over her objections, perhaps.
Yeah, it's the only thing I can think of. Or they already shot that B-roll from season one and god damn it, we're using it.
Right.
What if someone just changed the channel and doesn't know it's Christmas?
Right. So Scrooge Amanda's still in bed, still sniffling. Then there's Bruce to inspect her fur and pull a ghost Mr. Blackwell clipped in.
This god-awful thing must be a gift from Peter. You know, for a doctor, he has very little regard for life.
True.
Yeah. That, where's the lie?
Yeah. So he tells her to put it on because they're taking a trip to the past where Amanda watches her kid self sitting under a Christmas tree talking to her doll about how much daddy loves her. And then there's Palmer with some broad claiming he has to go away on Christmas. This is like the trashiest looking woman. Like, I certainly believe that Palmer dated, but like she does not look like she would be his type.
No, she's also dressed like an extra in a Jewel scene in Deadwood.
Yeah. What,
like it's that like Western trollop look. Mm-hmm. That's yeah. I don't think that's Palmer's jam. Maybe she was like a Kathy Ireland, like just like working partner.
But mm-hmm. Perhaps.
It wasn't the subtext.
No. So when Amanda whines that he can't go away on Christmas, he tells her that all the presents are to make up for his absence. And then little Amanda starts sobbing and adult Amanda leans over her to try and comfort her. Okay. I mean, I think it's supposed to be moving, but it's just kind of silly. Mm. Another night, another unwelcome visit from Bruce. Amanda is in her best pajamas of the episode in this season. I have to say, little tiny print. Very cute.
They are super cute.
She's obviously not thrilled to see him again, but he doesn't care and brings her to see her own funeral. So we're skipping Christmas present, I guess. Time considerations, I suppose. So she doesn't know how this could be her funeral. And Bruce explains, clip 11.
No, it couldn't be. There are no flowers, no mourners. What happened to me?
Well, your husband, Peter, told the authorities that you died in a tragic skiing accident, if you can believe that story.
I married Peter?
Hmm. And now he controls D&D as well as all of your assets.
If this is my funeral, where are my friends?
What friends are those, Amanda? People from the apartment building? Your employees? Well, what have you done to deserve their respect?
More than they ever did for me. Where's Peter? Where's my husband?
Probably with his mistress, I presume.
Well, that's bad writing. Probably with his mistress, or with his mistress, I presume, would be plenty. Yeah. Don't need them both. But let's assume that was Stanley Camel messing up the line and they just didn't have time to take it again.
Sure, that's true.
Rough stuff. But also, it's true. Who are Amanda's friends? Like,
yeah,
baby Jake would show up out of obligation.
Yeah.
That's kind of it. I mean, Allison probably would, too, because she's kind of a suck.
Yeah, that's true.
She sheepishly says she can't possibly die alone. Someone must love her. And Bruce tells her there's still time for her to change her future. Clip 12.
Amanda, Peter made you do certain things. Even a strong woman like you can fall prey to her dark side. But there is another side to you. There's a good side. If you don't change things, Peter will drag you down just like he did me. You must get rid of him.
Get rid of him? I created the monster. I helped him get control of D&D, and now I work for him. There's nothing I can do.
But there is. Peter even gave you the tools. He taught you everything you need to know. That's right. You have everything you need. You must destroy Peter before he destroys you.
Dun, dun, dun.
Sure.
It's impossible not to hear Peter made you do certain things, and even though we know what those certain things are, mm-hmm. and think, oh, butt stuff?
Butt stuff.
Okay, glad we were on the same page.
Yeah, oh, sure.
So Then Amanda wakes up, seemingly refreshed, and walks to the window, but there's no kid to throw a coin at, asking him to go get the goose that's as big as he is. So instead, she goes straight to dinner with the Cratchits, going over to the Tellermans on Christmas Day, when Donna and the college boys are eating. Again, these boys have a mom. Bruce's divorce is one of the things that ate up his savings. They mentioned it in this episode. So where is she for the first Christmas since her children's father's suicide? Who knows? Anyway, Donna is surprised to see Amanda at the door with a big gift basket. And she apologizes for being such a bitch the other day. Donna is way too nice, accepting some of the blame for having barged in. Instead of introducing Bruce's sons like the adults they are, Donna, like, hangs back and just points at them and says, Jason's at Stanford, Kyle's at USC, or they will be if the government grant they applied for comes through. And, of course, that's why Amanda's there. She has money for them. It will not cover all of their expenses, but she's arranged to have checks issued every semester. She thinks Bruce would have wanted it that way and adds that Kyle and Jason don't need to know where the money came from, which, class move.
Yeah. But having, if I were standing in that doorway, I wouldn't be giving Kyle shit because he has.
He glares at her. Jeez.
Stinkiest stink of the face.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's like, you farted, and I'm going to kill you. Like, buddy.
Yeah. Whereas Jason looks at her like, yeah, maybe I could get a leg over her. And like, maybe he could. He's cute.
Yeah, he's pretty cute.
So then she goes to Twin Oaks to apologize to Allison and say that her job is safe whenever Allison feels ready to come back. And then adds she wishes there were a recovery program for her personal demons. Like, there is. It's called therapy.
Yeah. Everyone on this show, get in it immediately.
And that's it. Merry therapy Christmas, everybody.
Oh, God.
Let's close things up by naming our episode MVP. Ghost Bruce. Who knew? So yeah. Fun to watch.
Yeah. May he now rest.
Indeed. His unquiet spirit came back to deal with his unfinished business, and now it's dealt with. Goodbye.
It's true.
Least valuable player. Oh, so many options. Damn.
I mean, you make a lot of good points about the ex Mrs. Bruce, but Kyle. What? I can think of one exception of Kyle's that are... Like, well, actually, no, two. But, like, why are Kyles so frequently dingleberries? Why is that, universe?
I'm going to say Kimberly. Bitch, you lost fair and square. You did not have to go calling Mrs. Carter. How does this serve you? It's not going to get you the baby back. This is just pure spite. And it's mean.
I think that's an excellent pick.
All right.
Next time on Again With This, Joe's new Mary Poppins has an agenda, Peter has a secret, Peter's new hire has it out for everyone except Billy, even though it's Billy, and Allison has a lady boner for Terry even after her stint at Twin Oaks. Your corneas are going to need 60 days at Visine Acres after you peep our visual aids, which you can find for every episode of Again With This on our website, againwiththispodcast.com. That's also where you'll find a link to buy our very special 90210 book, available in Kindle, audio, and of course, good old hardcover formats. To learn more, follow us on Twitter at AWT90210. And you don't have to wear all black to haunt our Patreon page. Just go to patreon.com/againwiththis. Tons of extra content, so join today. I'm Unknown Wassailant, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. My co-host is Feaster of Steven, Tara Ariano, and she's on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And our producer is famous original size drummer boy, David T. Cole. Talk to you next time. Ooh. What?